Hello, everybody. This is Press Gallery host Emma Graney. Just another quick reminder to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you want. You can also look at it on our website, which I very rarely tell you about, but that's where you find all the links to good stuff on the gallery, which is pretty fun. Leave us a rating if you would be so kind. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, shoot me a message. egraney@postmedia.com is my email address. Or you can find me on Twitter at Emma L. Graney. Thank you so much for all the feedback we've been getting lately. It has been awesome. Keep it up. We've only got a couple more weeks to go before we wrap it up for 2018. And we have our famous yearly news quiz, which is always a fun time. Enjoy this week's episode. Hello and welcome to the Press Gallery, the Edmonton Journal's politics podcast. I'm your host, provincial affairs reporter Emma Graney. It is Friday, November 30, 2018, and this is the Oil's Very Slippery Slope edition. With me today, my boss, Dave Breckenridge. How are you, mate?
I'm good. I thought you said the Oilers' Slippery Slope edition, and I thought, well, you know, we could talk hockey.
No, I don't understand your people's sports. Keith DeRyan, columnist. How are you, mate?
I'm doing very well.
Excellent. Good to see you. And from Calgary, Chris Farco, our colleague at the Calgary Herald. Ooh. How are you, mate?
It's Friday. I'm doing great.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So this week, as you may have gathered from that very, very intelligent title I came up with about 30 seconds ago. Thanks, guys. We're going to talk about oil prices and rail cars and pipelines, because you know what? We haven't done that enough lately here on the podcast. We're also going to talk a little bit about the new MSI funding formula. So basically what the province is going to be giving the big cities and how oil will impact that. Again, slippery slope. See what I did there? I linked them to the title.
Did. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Finally, we'll talk briefly about the committee kerfuffle that happened this week, because that's the kind of insider baseball stuff we know you all love so much. Let's get started with oil. That was, of course, the big news. Well, not just this week. It kind of snowballed from last week and the week before. Chris, I'd like to get you on this. Big developments when it comes to oil and rail and decisions by Premier Rachel Notley. Can you talk us through what happened, mate?
Absolutely. Well, what you've seen is an intersection of politics and energy, the likes we probably haven't seen in this province since the 1980s. So just a little bit of context, we've seen oil prices fall, global oil prices fall precipitously, about 30% in the last 6 weeks, and that is causing problems. But then the differential in Alberta, as everyone knows, is even more intense, and that's causing some big problems. So the Premier this week announced that rather than waiting around for Ottawa to help them buy some rail cars and some locomotives to move crude out of the province, she's going to do so herself. And she's not waiting around. They're going to try and, I guess, get themselves 80 locomotives and I think some 7,000 oil rail cars. And they can start moving crude out of this province probably in about a year's time. The estimates are it's going to cost, I believe, around $350 to $400 million in capital. But this is their sort of midterm solution to trying to attack the price differential. That's the one issue that's sort of bubbling. But the other one is the question of a government curtailment. Should the government of Alberta have a mandatory cut to oil production to try and resolve this problem in the short term? And that's just a boiling away in this oil patch and in the political circles as well.
That's been an interesting topic, because it's one of the things that, for example, Jason Kenney with the UCP has called for this curtailment of oil production. Premier Rachel Notley is apparently mulling this over during the weekend, and she has said in response to that, it's not off the table. Well, she hasn't said it's not, but she said nothing is off the table, which kind of broadly took that in. Do you think, are you hearing down in Calgary that Notley's going to be making a decision on this pretty quick smart here?
Yeah, I think she has to make a decision in the matter of days. This isn't a week's kind of decision. It's days. And one of the complicating factors here is the legislation that exists that would allow them to curtail production was written, I believe, in the 1970s and 80s. It's under the Minerals Act. And it only allows for curtailment of conventional production. But that's not the problem here. The problem is all of the additional bitumen production. I mean, there's more than 3 million barrels a day coming from bitumen. So they'd have to revise the legislation. And as you know only too well, this session is supposed to wind up sometime next week.
Yeah.
So the suspicion is that she'll be making an announcement, or at least she'll tip her cards one way or the other sometime in the middle of next week.
And I guess they could still pass this, because even if it's done on, you know, the last day of session, they could just basically wrestle it through. And I think that, well, the UCP is obviously behind it. Other parties parties don't really seem to have an issue, aside from Derek Fildebrand, who says it's collusion.
Right.
But they could pretty much just slam this right through the ledge.
Yeah, I mean, they could go quickly. The Alberta Party has also called for curtailment.
Right,
so
yeah.
if you've got the three main parties saying we're in favor of curtailing, then presumably they could move it quickly.
I like how the Alberta Party is one of the three main parties now.
Well, they were actually the first to call for it.
Yeah.
Almost 2 weeks ago, in fact, at this point.
I thought 11 right. months ago. Greg Clark was saying they were calling for it at the beginning of the year. I mean, it raises an interesting question. Everyone has been kind of freaking out about Jason Kenney, the free market conservative, advocating for government intervention in this. But as he pointed out on Twitter last night through, I believe it's a UCP staffer, or at least he's a UCP supporter. I don't know what his status in the party is. Paul Bachmut, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But he raises a good point, is that if we look at the euphemisms of democracy, we'll find out Alberta's oil doesn't belong to the people any more than Soviet factories belong to the workers. It belongs to the state. The state rightfully seeks to preserve state assets and is fully justified in doing so. And that's an interesting point that, yes, Jason Kenney may be a free market conservative, but at the end of the day, it is our resource,
yeah.
Our being the province's resource, and we get to do with it what we want. So that's the argument that conservatives may make, that even though we believe in free markets, it's still ours and we want to sell it or control the production of it as best we can.
You know what I find interesting here, though, is that by Jason Kenney coming out ahead of the government and saying that he's in favor of curtailment, I think it gives the government some skating room now that they might not have had a week ago, because I think before they were going to be open to accusations of meddling in the marketplace. But now you've got a good chunk of the oil industry saying, please move in and curtail. You've got some investors saying curtail. And now you've got the opposition party saying curtail. So I think it actually gives her more room to act that maybe she didn't have a couple of weeks ago.
On the other hand, it could work. It could backfire in a sense as well, because things are so polarized right now in the legislature. Those parties just hate each other. And with an election 6 months away, the fact that Jason Kenney has come out and said, let's do this. I wonder if Rachel Notley is now more reluctant because she knows the UCP is going to crow about this. Oh, it's the NDP bowing to UCP ideas, bowing to UCP pressure. So it's possible it could work the other way as well.
What's really interesting when it talks about this notion of forcing the oil companies to curtail production, some of those big oil companies, they're making a mint off of this. Like, they are making an absolute killing because they have gone and diversified this nifty word that gets thrown around so very often in Alberta. And what they're doing is processing it and then selling it on for a massive profit. So for them, this is extremely lucrative. But it's your small to medium-sized operations that are being absolutely hammered here, and they're actually having to spend money in order to get their oil to be processed, which is kind of nuts when you think about it.
It's true. I mean, I think you're talking about the integrated companies.
That's
the word I keep hearing, right? And so it would include Suncor and Imperial, the people that can essentially sell the oil to themselves and refine it. And so, yes, they actually benefit from a big differential and low prices generally. And that's what's complicating this issue, is that those big companies do not want any kind of curtailment. They love this right now. So any way the premier goes on this, there's going to be opposition.
Yep.
One of the other interesting things is if we think back to 3 or 4 years ago, where the premier sat on stage with several of the CEOs of big oil companies to announce the climate change plan. On the one side, you had Murray Edwards, and Murray Edwards, of course, is the chairman of Canadian Natural Resources. They are now in favor of curtailment. On the other side, you saw Steve Williams, from the head of Suncor, also on that stage with Premier Notley. He is obviously against the idea of curtailment. So she's facing two very powerful business forces arguing completely different responses to this crisis.
Rachel Notley, was it last week, I think, announced the oil envoys, where she had three handpicked people who would go and talk to industry players, stakeholders, different levels of government, and then basically come back to her with recommendations within a few days. Have you heard anything about how those actual discussions are going? I've not heard anything.
Jason Kenney mentioned in his press conference earlier this week that he has talked to Brian Topp and the envoys, and did mention this idea of a mandatory curtailment, and said it was a pleasant meeting, a good exchange of ideas, but he got no indication about which way they were leaning on this. That's it. That's the only thing I've heard.
I do wonder what recommendations they're going to come up with there, if anything.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I think the options are really limited here because, you know, we've talked about the long-term solution here being pipelines and the midterm solution being rail. But the short-term solution is really either you curtail and the government comes in and mandatorily does this with, say, a 5 or 10% production cut, or you don't curtail and you just allow the economic pain to be so great that the producers who have sort of the worst production, like the highest cost production, they have to exit the market. I don't think there's a lot of middle ground there. The only other thing that people are talking about is maybe a legitimate option is that the government somehow move into this system, and this gets complicated, so I won't dive too deep into it, but just how companies nominate space on the pipeline system. Right now, there's too much oil trying to get onto the pipelines, so they have to be rationed. And the government is being called to sort of move into there and make it more efficient so that producers can get their oil on there in a better fashion.
That's an interesting idea.
This is the talk about air barrels, right? That companies will buy allotments and they might buy more allotment than they need to ensure they have the proper space, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. So basically, at the beginning of the month, is my understanding, all the companies, you know, sort of line up, a queue up on how much oil they think they want to get on the main Enbridge pipeline. And then they get a portion to a percentage of that. Maybe it's 40 or 50 or 60%. But some of those companies have other options as well. They can move on other pipelines. They can also move by rail. So the question is, are there so-called air barrels, barrels that aren't being used or don't need to be used that maybe should be allowed to be used by maybe some of the smaller producers who don't have other options? It's complicated, but it is important for the companies and the producers who are struggling to get their oil to market.
I'm curious on the rail thing. I just have this image in my head where there's some kind of rail yard somewhere with all these disused trains just, you know, hanging out, waiting to be picked up by Rachel Notley. Where are we getting these trains from?
You're not going down to the GM dealership and buying a locomotive, that's for sure. And the problem is if you talk to people in the railway industry, like, they're already under huge demand to move a big grain crop and potash and, you know, lumber. So it's not like there's a bunch of spare rail cars and locomotives particularly hanging around.
Yeah.
And if they are, they're already being used down in the States because they're increasing their oil production by a huge amount down in Texas in the Permian Basin. So that's part of the reason why they're going to have to wait 9 to 12 months to get those locomotives.
Dang. Well,
there's no simple response here.
Well, it's 9 to 12 months just to even get the first ones to get enough to actually move 120,000 barrels per day. We're talking August 2020. That was the optimistic outlook of the government in their announcement earlier this week. So, I mean, we're talking a year and a half or longer, actually, to get up to that kind of level.
So which will get started first, the pipeline construction or having enough trains to move more oil to market? Like we can start a ticker on the website or something. We can get that going.
Right. And I mean, there is actually serious doubts about whether this is a good move in the end. I mean, the numbers Chris put out in terms of the cost, you know, $350-400 million to do this. That's a major, major expense. And talk to some economists. There was a Scotiabank economist report out a couple weeks ago that said, you know, by the time the first trains roll around next year, potentially line three should be up and running by that point. A lot of the oil companies are making arrangements on their own for extra rail capacity, and the differential might improve by that point. And the supplies, the oversupply in Alberta might be in a much better situation, which makes you wonder if this is really the right road for Alberta to be going down.
I agree, Keith, but there is sort of the other thing that's lurking in the background, and that is the unknown over pipelines. So as it stands right now, the market's oversupplied by, you know, 200,000-300,000 barrels, and rail is beginning to ramp up. The next pipeline project in the queue is Enbridge's Line 3 replacement project. It's supposed to come online near the end of next year. That'll add about 350,000 barrels a day of capacity. Theoretically, that should make everything good, but the production continues to increase out of the oil sands, and the next pipeline projects behind that are Trans Mountain and Keystone, and they're both stuck in limbo. So nobody really knows when are those pipelines going to come on stream, and we could be back in this crazy situation in 12 to 18 months. So that's why the premier's saying, hey, even if we maybe don't necessarily need these rail cars at that moment, this is a good hedge against yet another delay in those pipelines.
For sure. Just briefly, when I did hear about this rail announcement, I just had this image of Rachel Notley as Ralph from The Simpsons with that you know, that themed Valentine's Day card he gives to Lisa going, I choose you. And I can't get it out of my head.
Sun front page designer Chad Huckaluck also had that in his head, as that was the...
Much
maligned, apparently, front page. People on Twitter did not like our take on that.
Well, people on Twitter are wrong. So let's...
That's never happened before.
Let's move along very briefly now. And this, of course, does stem from our discussion about oil, because oil does tend to play rather a large part in Alberta's coffers. But the government and the big cities have finally reached a funding agreement this week after some not-so-happy discussions between the city and the province. Very late last month, I think it was, Joe Cicci, the finance minister, he told us at Inns on his way into cabinet that the cities just, quote, weren't coming to the table. And he implied that they were demanding things that the province just was not willing or able to give them. And it really did seem like they were at loggerheads at that point. Then Edmonton Mayor Don Iverson came out and said, it's not useful to try and, you know, negotiate through the media, and we need a meeting with the Premier to sort this out, lickety split. And then finally, they've come to the table this week. So that was nice. Chris, I actually want to get you on this. Has Calgary been really demanding a lot more money from the province? Do you know?
Oh, absolutely. They've got their hands out all the time.
We only need to look at the Olympic thing where they wanted to keep all that cash from the province, right?
That was a rather bold call. A failed call, I suspect, but a bold call.
Well, it even dates back all the way to the 2004 election, if I'm not mistaken, when Calgary Mayor Dave Bronconier was lobbying then Premier Ralph Klein for a ton of cash. And Klein just basically threw money at the cities and said, go away so I can run an election. So Calgary has a good history of being loud about their fiscal wants from the province.
So this new agreement, it replaces the MSI, which is going to expire in 2021 or 2022, somewhere around there. But basically, under this new legislation, the two largest cities, that's Edmonton and Calgary, obviously, are going to split $500 million in 2022 and 23, and that's after the current revenue sharing plan expires. That's the word, Emma. Good job. So that's an old agreement that was actually inked in 2007. Now, Calgary is expected to get $289 million and Edmonton $211 million in the first year of this new deal. Now, what was really interesting is after that, it gets tied to provincial revenues. So the idea there is that if things are going really well in the province, you know, oil's $100 a barrel again. Ha ha ha, they laugh, that'll never happen. Then the cities will get quite a windfall. But if we're in the kind of straits where we are now, then the cities have to kind of share in that pain as well. I was interested, though, Don Iverson and Hayden Enchias as well, I think, seem pretty happy with this. They don't seem unhappy with it, Dave?
They don't, although I do find it interesting, because you'll hear from time to time politicians say the best time to build infrastructure is not during a boom. You'll hear politicians say that the best time to build infrastructure is during a recession because you can get things for cheaper. So to tie municipal infrastructure money to when Alberta is doing well could potentially put cities at a disadvantage when it comes to procurement and procuring labor and costs to build. So I find that interesting. But in some ways, it does make sense. The province has more money in good times to give to the cities, but the city may have to do some planning around when they build. I don't know how that's going to work.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any flexibility built into the agreement where a city could potentially receive the money from the province, stick it in a bank account for a year or two, and then find a more advantageous time to build. I don't know.
Doubtful,
yes.
There's another interesting part of this as well. When it comes to those kind of transit infrastructure projects, there's a $400 million annual transit allocation. So that starts in 2027-28. So that's $400 million in annual funding that will be evenly split between Edmonton and Calgary. And then that is on top of the $3 billion that was promised until 2026-27, which is going to fund things like the Green Line in Calgary and the Valley Line West LRT up here in Edmonton. So there is still that very specific, you must use this for transit money, which is kind of interesting too, because it means that they are getting some oversight as to what they have to do with that money.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also tied to the carbon tax, right? That's the main thing. So, and that doesn't start till 2027, 2028, as you mentioned. So theoretically, there may be no carbon tax as of this point next year, although the mayor, or at least Mayor Iverson, said that the funding is guaranteed through some source, whether that's carbon tax or something else. I was a little confused on that, but these dates are so far in the future at this point. The MSI, the main source of funding, not till 2022, 23. This transit funding, not till 2027. A lot can happen between then and now. We may have several new governments in place, but before then, a lot of this could be undone.
Yeah, if Alberta's anything to go by, you could have at least six new premiers in that time.
It's true. It's true.
And doesn't all of this, you know, there's so many spending commitments that have been made now by the NDP government on the carbon tax that it really seems like this paints the next government. If another government comes in and wants to get rid of the carbon tax, where are they going to get these multi-billion dollars of revenue to fill some of these commitments that are out there? Like it's a very interesting box that it would paint, you know, Jason Kenney if his government gets into power.
I don't think it would be any surprise to see this come up as an election issue from the NDP saying, hey, you vote UCP, Calgary and Edmonton. Well, guess what? There goes your transit funding. There goes your MSI. All those guarantees we made, out the window.
Yeah, it seems obvious that there is definitely a bit of politicking in the decision to make these announcements to get this deal done before the election and to tie a lot of it to carbon tax funding. As a way of kind of priming the pump for a harsh debate during the campaign in the spring.
At the Rural Municipalities Association conference and at other times as well, I know that I've said to Jason Kenney, well, what's going to happen then with these projects like the Green Line in Calgary that are tied to carbon tax funding? Like, do you just pull them? What's your plan there? And he has basically said, no, if things are kind of, you know, underway and, you know, they're already being funded, then we'll just keep that going. So then the natural follow-up is, but how then? Where does the money come from? And the answer then is, you just wait and see our election platform. It's going to be fully costed.
Can't wait. Can't wait.
Yeah, that's supposed to be coming out in early next year, I think they're actually going to be releasing that. They're finalizing it all over the winter. Happy days. Just briefly, I want to talk about the committee kerfuffle inside baseball, but quite funny this week. Keith, you were watching what was going on. You're already chuckling to yourself, mate.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous what happened, but
how dare you? How dare you? It was political intrigue at its finest, Keith.
Yeah, I mean, it happened Monday night, so I didn't see it live, but certainly saw the reaction Monday night and Tuesday morning, and it was essentially the group of independents and the Alberta Party stuck down in the darkened northwestern corner of the chamber. They are not well represented on committees to begin with, and the government put forward a motion to change the committee structure a bit, mostly to remove Robin Luff from public accounts and a couple of other ones and shift some other folks around. And as usual, the independents wanted to make amendments saying, hey, government, don't do this. But as soon as the government made the motion, the UCP stood up and invoked this very little known, very little used procedure to basically cut off debate and allow no
49-2.
49-2. Last time it was used, apparently 2008, and it cut off debate. The amendments were disallowed or not even allowed to come to the floor, and the committee assignments went through, and that was it. And boy, those independents, Greg Clark, Robin Luff, Derek Fildebrand, they were not happy.
In fairness, they are the Alberta Party and the Freedom Conservative Party, Keith. They're not independents. That's only Robin Luff.
That's true.
But it was actually kind of interesting to watch this unfold, because you never see that thing being used. And I was watching it on TV because I'm the kind of person that I am. And it was like Jason Nixon from the UCP just went to stand up as soon as Larrabee hadn't even quite sat down at that point. And I asked him afterwards, was there collusion? Because that's what Greg Clark, Derek Fildebrand and Robin Luff said. It was so obvious that the NDP and the UCP had talked about this before they came to the chamber, because the speaker knew what 49-2 is, even though it's hardly ever used. She understood what it was and was just willing to kind of roll with it. Luff, Fildebrand and Clark were going to try and argue with this. And then they were absolutely furious with this, with the fact that Jason Nixon from the UCP would get up and curtail debate in this way. Particularly Derek Fildebrand was pissed off, saying, "Where's the legacy Wild Rose now, Jason? How dare you cut off debate? That would never have happened under the Wild Rose. What have you done? You've forgotten your roots," basically. Didn't come to anything because it got pushed through, and there you have it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Brian Mason, the last time this happened, the NDP that was sitting in that darkened northwest corner of the chamber, right? It was a two or a four-person caucus. And Brian Mason, when this was used against his party, he called it an act of political thuggery back in 2008, had a little bit of a different view this time. He basically said, well, this was just some, you know, committee amendment, wasn't that important, and we don't have time in the House to be, you know, allowing these endless amendments on things that we're not going to allow anyway, so.
Yeah. And back then that was on a bill. So he said, you can't compare apples and oranges. That was a bill. This is committee appointments. I said, what? So committees aren't important enough to care about in the House? And he went, that's not what I'm saying, Emma.
Well, apparently that's what the Brian Mason is saying, that the committees aren't important enough to debate in the House. And the idea that, you know, we don't want to hear amendments on something we're going to disallow anyway. Well, isn't that the point of sitting in the House, is to debate amendments, even to motions, and get things on the record, get reasons on the record as to why you oppose them? And I think it is quite offensive for someone who was so against this when he was in opposition to turn around and say, oh, no, it's not a big deal.
No, it's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. It's fine because it's us, and we're good guys. So Jason Nixon said, no, there was no collusion, but I did tell the NDP that I would be getting this through because I need my guys on committees to be able to be there first thing on Tuesday morning. That's, of course, the two new UCP MLAs who are elected through by-elections, Layla Goodridge and Devon Dreeshan. And then Derek Fildebrand got up, being the kind of guy Derek Fildebrand is, he got up the next day and invoked 49-2 on an actual bill, and everyone lost their minds in the chamber and were like, what do we do now?
I think we're looking at it the wrong way, though. We're talking about the polarization of the NDP and the UCP, and maybe they can come together. Maybe there is a great common cause, and the common cause is the independents who they want to push out of the way.
Let's beat up the little guy. We can agree on that.
That's a good campaign slogan, I think.
We'll beat up the little guy. I want to move on to our regular segment, Good Stuff from the Gallery, in which we recommend things we've seen or heard or listened to lately or read that we think you might also enjoy. Varko, do you want to start us off, mate?
Absolutely. Well, just as a happenstance, I was at my mechanic shop the other day and I was listening to some music which sounded like a young Johnny Cash singing. And I said, hey, who is that that you're listening to? And he said, that's Colter Wall. That is the son of the former Premier of Saskatchewan, Brad Wall. And let me tell you, I've been listening to his albums for the last 2 weeks nonstop. They are fantastic. If you like country music and you like old style country music, a la Johnny Cash, I highly recommend giving it a listen.
I know Colter. I would also highly recommend that. He's a really delightful young lad. I know him from Saskatchewan. Dave.
All right. This weekend starts officially the Christmas music season. I'm not one of those people who's a big fan of starting it on November 12th. I usually wait till December 1st. And one of my favorite Christmas songs of all time is the Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York. So the piece I'm recommending, it's a few years old now, but it's a very good retelling of the history of that song itself. It's called Fairy Tale of New York, the story behind the Pogues' classic Christmas anthem. It's from The Guardian. It's about 6 years old now, but it's a really good read. And then it's worthwhile to listen to the story.
I do like that Christmas song. It's sad and gritty.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I'm going to recommend a documentary I watched on Netflix this week. It's actually from last year, but I had not seen it before. It's called LA 92. And it's about the Rodney King riots. And it's the history of how that happened, compares it with another historic riot, and it goes deep into all this unseen footage from what was happening down on the ground in LA in 1992. I vaguely remember this, watching it when I was like 11 years old on TV in Australia, but it was all very removed. And I didn't know that there was such a massive tie to the Korean community in Los Angeles, that they were kind of seen as exploiting the black community in Los Angeles because they owned all the stores, and how a lot of the rioting kind of targeted them specifically, or their stores. A lot of the looting did anyway. So that's a really interesting aside that I didn't know about. It is an extremely brutal watch. You see some pretty brutal stuff, but it is definitely worth watching. And truly appreciating what happened back in 1992. Keith, take us home, mate.
I'm going to recommend a movie called The Front Runner about Gary Hart's failed presidential run in 1988. It's based on a book by Matt Bai that came out a few years ago that I quite enjoyed. The movie is not as good as the book, but is still a fair representation. And it's just a very interesting look at the a moment in American politics when things changed, when politicians' private lives became fodder for the media. And we are continuing to see the result of that today.
Absolutely. Guys, thank you so much for joining me. Dave Breckenridge, Keith Durine, and Chris Darko down in Calgary. I forgot your last name for a brief second there. Thank you so much for joining me, and we will be back this time next week with more Alberta politics fun on the Press Gallery.